Okay, so yeah, the Apostolic Fathers, even ancient secular, ancient non-Christian authors, Thallus, 52 A.D., he's still trying to explain away the darkness that occurred when Jesus was crucified. Okay? It's over 20 years after Jesus was crucified, he's still trying to explain away the supernatural aspects of Jesus' life. The Jewish Talmud, it was oral tradition, oral teachings of the rabbis, but after the temple was destroyed in 70 A.D., between 70 and 200 A.D., the pupils of the rabbis began to write down what the rabbis had taught them, and they refer to Jesus as a sorcerer who led the Jewish people astray, and then because of that he was hanged on a tree on the eve of Passover under Pontius Pilate. That's given a lot. Now, number one, calling him a sorcerer. The enemies of Jesus are admitting there was a supernatural aspect of his life that they could not deny. So they claimed he was coming from the other side. By the way, the Jews have not been able to retain that argument. Show me a leading Jewish rabbi who calls Jesus a sorcerer today. They can't. He has had such a great impact on the history of mankind that today, you want to know what Jews are saying today, even though their own Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, this commentary on the scriptures that is held in higher esteem by many Orthodox Jews than the scriptures themselves, and they reject Jesus as a sorcerer now, and now they talk about him as either, I would say most Jew Orthodox rabbis would say Jesus was a great moral teacher, one of the greatest teachers of all time. He taught us to love our neighbor, love God with everything we've got. Other rabbis go a little bit further and say he was a prophet. He was a Jewish prophet who was rejected by the Jews and killed. Many of the Jewish prophets, their message was rejected and they were killed. I think if God sent a prophet to America today, he'd probably end up getting killed. I mean, that's what happens. That's what happens with most prophets. So it's not an anti-Semitic statement, especially since even Jewish rabbis are acknowledging that his own people turned on Jesus. But they say he was a prophet. Some are saying he was a great prophet. Some are actually saying he may have been the greatest Jewish prophet who ever lived. It's just that the apostles misunderstood his message. Rabbi, not the guy that's up here from Mercer Island, Lapin, not Rabbi Lapin, but Rabbi Lapid, actually, and he's a New Testament scholar too. He acknowledges that, Lapid does, he acknowledges that Jesus bodily rose from the dead. His name is Pincus Lapid, P-I-N-C-H-A-S-L-A-P-I-D-E. And Lapid argues that Jesus bodily rose from the dead, that's historical fact, there's no way around it, that he was the greatest Jewish prophet who ever lived, and he used to argue that the apostles totally misunderstood his message, okay? Now he seems to be watering that down, said, okay, maybe they accepted his message, maybe they only slightly misunderstood his message, but he was the Messiah for the Gentiles, but we Jews are still waiting for our Messiah. So, I mean, that's as close as you can come to accepting Jesus as the Messiah and still rejecting him as a Jew, is saying, okay, he is such a great prophet that he's the Gentile Messiah, but we're still waiting for it. And by the way, this is becoming more and more common. Rabbi Lapin from up here, he backs a ministry, a Jewish ministry, a Jewish apologetics ministry, where the author wrote the book where he's arguing that Jesus, that it's the two Messiah theory. That there's a Messiah ben Joseph, a suffering Messiah, and that may have been Jesus, but then there's a Messiah ben David still to come, who's going to be a conquering Messiah, and they're still waiting for them. But this one guy, I think if I remember correctly, he makes Jesus out to be a Gentile Messiah. It's amazing how the biggest argument that the Talmud's accusation that Jesus was a sorcerer, the biggest claim that doesn't hold any water, is that those who have the most respect for the Jewish Talmud, Orthodox Jews to this day, no longer accept that. They accept, yeah, okay, Jesus, many of them accept Jesus was a miracle worker, was probably a prophet, at least a great teacher, maybe even the Messiah for the Gentiles. So, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a weak thesis to hold. but it just shows how powerful Jesus's witness has been. So you find many non-Christian authors. Tacitus talks about Jesus being crucified by Pilate, and that Christianity was then shut down for a small amount of time, a small interval of time, and then all of a sudden it broke out again and it exploded and it grew all the way through the Roman Empire, all the way to Rome. Well, that's very consistent. That's exactly what you would expect a Roman historian who's writing about 112 AD. That's exactly what you would expect him to write if the book of Acts is true. That Jesus gets crucified under Pilate, like the Gospels say, and Christianity just comes to a screeching halt. Christianity was what? It was a Jewish messianic movement. They believed Jesus was the Messiah. But the Messiah is supposed to do what? He's supposed to rescue the Jews. If Messiah dies without rescuing the Jews, you have dead Messiah equals dead Messiah movement. Jesus died, so you had dead Messiah movement. But it was only stopped for a short interval. And then all of a sudden it started growing again and it exploded and grew all the way throughout, spread throughout the Roman Empire. How short was that interval? For the book of Acts, you could find out it was a 50-day interval. After Jesus rose from the dead, appeared to his disciples over a period of 40 days, then ascended to heaven on the day of Feast of Pentecost, 50 days after the crucifixion, the Holy Spirit baptized the church, and then Peter preached, 3,000 got saved, and from then on, even Josephus records tens of thousands of Jews accepting Jesus as their Messiah and Savior in Jerusalem before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So this is exactly what you would expect to find from non-Christian authors, ancient authors. You wouldn't expect them to say, well, I believe in this stuff, but you would expect them to say, this is what the early church believed, and these are some of the things that happened. 112 AD, Pliny the Younger. Okay, he's writing to one of the Roman emperors, and he says that Christians sing hymns to Christ as to a god. And, you know, we put the word on in Koine Greek, in classical Greek, it's not there. So he says they sing hymns to Christ as to God. He probably meant a god, because as a Roman he believed in many gods. But what he's saying is that the early church, you know, 112 AD, he's looking at Christians and he's saying, yeah, and these Christians are the same way the Christians of the generation before them were. And yet, what makes Christians Christians, what separates them from the Jews and from other religions, they sing hymn songs to the founder of their religion, and they treat him the way we treat our gods. Okay? I mean, even, you know, the evidence, Maranatha, ancient Aramaic creed, come Lord come, talking about Jesus, but that means come Yahweh come in Aramaic. When Jesus is Lord, you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, believe in your heart God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Jesus is Lord there with the word Kurios for Lord, but there it has to mean God, because the whole reason why Christians coined the phrase Jesus is Lord is because the Romans were trying to force people to say Caesar is Lord, Caesar is God. The Jews said no, Yahweh is God. Yahweh is Lord. And then if you were a Jew who became a Christian, you say, oh yeah, well Jesus is Yahweh, so Jesus is Lord. So it's basically the mind of the Jews and the Jews who became Christians, the earliest Christians, Yahweh equals Jesus equals Lord does not equal Caesar. Okay? You have tremendous archaeological confirmation. You know, there's never been any find in archaeology that has disproven anything in the Bible. And yet there are probably thousands of finds that have confirmed the Bible. The book of Acts alone, you have hundreds of archaeological finds proving its reliability. The ancient creeds, I mentioned a few. You even have 1 Corinthians 15, 3-8. Paul gives a list. He's writing in the mid-50s AD to the Corinthians. But he quotes from an ancient creed. New Testament scholars tell us he quotes from an ancient creed that goes all the way back to the 30s AD, possibly even the early 30s AD, about Jesus after he rose from the dead appearing alive to Peter, to James, to the 12 apostles on at least two different occasions, to over 500 witnesses at one time, and then to one as untimely born, because he appeared to Paul after the ascension, he appeared to Paul as well. So basically, you go back to these ancient creeds, Philippians 2, 5 to 11, you have Jesus exists, continues to exist in nature as God, but he didn't use that to his advantage. And then it tells us later in that creed that every knee will bow to him and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. You go to Isaiah 44, and that's every knee will bow to Yahweh and every tongue confess that Yahweh is Lord. It's very clear from these ancient creeds that go back to the early 30s AD. Larry Hurtado does a great job on this. His work, The Lord Jesus Christ, he argues that, in fact, the title The Lord Jesus Christ, he says Paul was using that title when he started writing. It probably predates Paul by a good decade or two. And right there, the Lord Jesus Christ, calling Jesus Christ means Messiah. So Jesus is the Messiah, but he's also the Lord. When you're speaking in religious terms, HaKurios, the Lord, you're saying Jesus is God and he is Messiah. One of the early titles of Jesus. You could even take, we won't have time to do it in this course, but if I give a course on New Testament introduction or historical evidences for Jesus, tremendous evidence for Jesus' deity, that he claimed to be God, and evidence for his resurrection, that he proved to be God, you can build that, like Dr. Gary Habermas, my old professor from Liberty University, you can build a case for that solely on what the vast majority of New Testament scholars will give you today. So the Jesus Seminar, in fact, the Jesus Seminar gives you enough to make a real strong case. Look at Marcus Borg, the leading member of the Jesus Seminar. He acknowledges that the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus were not visions, were not hallucinations. He calls them apparitions. Now, he denies that Jesus' bodily rose from the dead, but he's saying somehow there was something objectively real that the apostles and others in groups really thought they were seeing Jesus visiting them, but they weren't hallucinating, because hallucinations can only happen in one person's mind. No two people can share the same one. Well, Borg was lucky he didn't accept that debate with me at Oregon State University when Camps from Schaefer Price had me come down, because I want an answer on that. If they're not hallucinations, but they're apparitions, but they're not real bodily appearances, what in the world do you mean by apparitions? Gary Habermas, his view on, his spin on Marcus Borg is that, to the best that he can figure out, he doesn't want to admit it, but he probably holds to a spiritual resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Not a full-blown physical resurrection, but Gary Habermas, he's the world's foremost expert on New Testament scholarship's view of the resurrection. And he says that about 72% of New Testament scholars, the world's leading New Testament scholars, writing between 1975 and 2003, because he's read everything of those guys, and in French, German, and English, and those are the three main languages right now for New Testament studies, that 72% believe that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead in some way, shape, or form. Now, the most common view, it's not the majority position, the most common view, anybody want to guess what that is among New Testament scholars today? The world's leading New Testament scholars. That would basically be five or six guys from the Jesus Seminar would qualify for that. It's such a high level. These are usually guys who are department heads of New Testament departments in the world's leading universities. The number one view, it's about 30... No, it's actually high. Probably might even be close to 40%, is that Jesus bodily rose from the dead. Now, not all these guys are believers, by the way. So some of them would just say, I don't understand how that happened. There's some kind of freak event. But the second highest view is a spiritual resurrection. So they're saying he rose from the dead, but we don't really believe it was his body. But that's weird, too, because most acknowledge the... So over 72% acknowledge the empty tomb. So the guys with the spiritual resurrection then also have to explain the empty tomb some way. You know, it's like, well, where is the body? Well, I don't know where the body was, but I don't think a body can rise from the dead, but it was missing. I don't think, nobody believes the apostles stole it anymore. no intellectual. You might get some bonehead guy. They hold to the spiritual resurrection, and then when they're confronted with the empty tomb, then they didn't know what to say, so they said that they believed his body evaporated into gases. And it's like, why would Jesus' body evaporate into gases? So that's kind of problematic. It's also problematic if you go to their New World Translation in John chapter 2, even in their own translation, they translate it the same way we do. And Jesus said, look, they wanted a sign because he cleansed the temple. Give us a sign that you have this authority. He said, destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days. And he said, it took 46 years for Herod to build this temple. And you're going to build it in one day? And then John says, he's talking about the temple of his body. And it's in the New World Translation. He was talking about the temple of his body. Jesus said, destroy this temple. He was talking about his body, according to the New World Translation, the Jehovah's Witness translation, as well as all other translations. He said, destroy this temple, destroy this body, and I will raise this body up on the third day. So Jehovah's Witnesses have a serious problem there. And even in Luke 24, the apostles were thinking of becoming Jehovah's Witnesses. They thought they were seeing a spirit. Jesus said, no, a spirit doesn't have a body of flesh and bones, as you see that I have. Here, touch my wounds. Then he said, give me a piece of fish, and he ate broiled fish in their midst. So he went way out of his way to prove to them that he had bodily risen from the dead. So a lot of people have a hard time. How can he be bodily and go through walls? Well, number one, he didn't go through walls. Okay? In his resurrection body, and I believe in our resurrection bodies, we'll have this ability as well, he's not limited by space. I mean, he can only be in one space at a time, but he can go from point A to point B by going from point A directly to point B. He doesn't need to cover the ground in between. So he's basically traveling at the speed of thought. See, Jesus was not outside the upper room, looking around, making sure nobody's looking, and then he floated up into the air, and then he got sucked into the wall and popped out the other side. Now, that's the way most evangelicals preach it on Sundays. Like, no, because he only appeared for the most part on Sundays during the 40 days. So what is he laying down under a canoe, something, hiding from people the rest of the time, you know? And what, you know, is he like, oh man, this is a bummer. I mean, I'm in Galilee now. I gotta go, you know, dozens of miles. I gotta start heading towards Judea and go down towards Jerusalem. And he's running all over the place, trying not to be seen by people. No. Where was he a second before he was in the upper room? Well, I know he's probably at the Father's right hand. See, the only reason why he ascended slowly into heaven, and he just went into the clouds and then disappeared, was just to let the apostles know, don't expect me to come back again. Okay, here's the Great Commission. Go into all nations, make disciples, baptize them in the name of the Triune God, teach them what I commanded you, lo, I'm with you always even to the end of the age. I'm going now, guys. So he goes up slowly, and then even two angels, just in case the apostles didn't get it. Why are you looking up to the clouds? The same Jesus will return the same way. He's going to come amidst the clouds again. His first appearance to Mary Magdalene, right? First appearance, she starts hugging him, and she didn't, you know, she's talking with him and she didn't recognize him, okay? Could have been any number of things. He could have been wearing a hood. She could have been looking down out of modesty, not wanting to make eye contact with a man. Very, very humble, very righteous culture back then. But, you know, you don't expect to see somebody alive 3 days after their death, okay? But once he called her Mary, the way he called her Mary, the way he pronounced her name, is a way that only Jesus could pronounce her name. I'm longing for the day when I hear Jesus call me by name. Or when I die and go to be with the Lord, or if he returns before I die, and the first time I hear him, the way he says, man, I'm sure it's going to have a pretty big impact on my life. And these important people in my life, I can think of how they pronounce my name. But once she called her by name, she recognized. And what did she do? She got a triple WF lock on him. She got him in a bear hug, and we just squeezed it. She was like, "Man, you died once. You know, I'm not going to let you go. You're not you're not going. Kind of like a mother with her son, thinking her son's gonna, you know, get hurt or something, but she just got him in a death lock. And he said, look, I haven't, you gotta let me go, because I gotta ascend to my father. Now, is he saying, let go of me, you can't hold on to me for 41 days, because 40 days from now, I gotta go, right, I gotta ascend to my father? No. I think what he's basically saying is, look, I got a timetable to keep, I got a schedule here, and right now I'm scheduled for a visit with my father. So don't be hanging on to me right now. I'm going to go to be with my father immediately. And then I'm going to, later on today, I'm going to appear to the apostles, and I'm going to be appearing over the next 40 days and all, but I don't think he's talking about the ascension 39 days after that, or 36 days after that, whatever. I think what he's talking about is when I'm not appearing to people, I'm at the Father's right hand, because he's traveling at the speed of thought. He's at the Father's right hand. He says, I want to be in the upper room. Boom, he's in the upper room. We could do that, by the way, right now. We can, in our mind, I could say Hawaii. Whether you've been there or not, if you've seen postcards of Hawaii or Discovery Channel or Travel Station, think of Hawaii. When you think about Hawaii with the beach and the sunset and the palm trees, okay? So in our minds, we travel to Hawaii. But the problem is our bodies hold us back. We can't physically get there immediately. But instantaneously, our minds can go there, okay? During Bible lectures, theology lectures, it's amazing how many different places our minds visit. Sometimes the only place our minds are not is the place where the lecture is being given. But when we get in our resurrection, it's like our physical body isn't going to hold us back anymore, because our natural bodies will become supernatural. It is literally in the Greek, the way Paul puts it, 1 Corinthians 15, our soulish bodies will become spiritual bodies. So it's still the same body. The body that is buried is the body that is raised, Paul says. Same body, but changed, transformed. Which is why the holes in Jesus' hands and feet and spirit side, those were not fake things. Those were the real wounds. Okay? Now, I'm glad Jesus chose to let all the swelling go down and we don't have to see torn off pieces of flesh and stuff. And somebody has said this, you know, it's scary, it's fascinating, but it's, as far as I can see from the scriptures, it's true. But there's only going to be five man-made things in heaven. And those are the five wounds of Christ. And that's a reminder to us of not so much what we did to him, but what he did for us. But whatever the case, Marcus Borg is very close, without admitting any kind of resurrection, he's actually very close to at least acknowledging. What Marcus Borg will do is when Mary supposedly appears, Roman Catholic circles and stuff, he'll say, well, look, the apparitions of Mary. By the way, there are some evidence that things have occurred, like in Fatima. There is some good evidence that something weird was going on. But it doesn't look like biblical miracles. It looks more like the types of things that we see in the UFO phenomenon, which I think is demonic. But whatever the case, so basically what he's trying to do, he's trying to say, yeah, something real occurred. It's a religious experience, but it's a real objective religious experience. And we don't know enough to talk about it. So it's almost like this guy's hoping that eventually we'll prove ESP, extrasensory perception, that there's a sixth sense, a religious sense. So there's some religious thing, but it really wasn't supernatural, and Jesus wasn't really risen. Yet his explanation of the resurrection comes very close to what we would call spiritual resurrection. If it's not a hallucination in the mind, there's something objective. And he's calling them apparitions, which is kind of a Catholic way of saying appearances. And if he doesn't believe they're bodily appearances, then they must be spiritual appearances, but still objective. That sounds a lot like spiritual resurrection, which isn't good enough, but what it shows is, in their attempt to deny the resurrection, even some of the most liberal New Testament scholars today are admitting to some type of resurrection, while trying to fight it with everything they've got. their backs against the corner. In fact, you know, I was wondering, how is Satan, New Testament studies are going, European scholarship sounds almost like evangelical scholarship on so many of these points. Sometimes European scholarship is more conservative than conservative scholarship, because it's the cutting-edge liberal scholars that are dating John's Gospel to the mid-50s A.D., you very rarely will you find an evangelical doing that. And I thought, how is Satan going to pull this off? I mean, the evidence is so overwhelming that Jesus is God and that he rose from the dead. Well, just when I started thinking that, lo and behold, the radical, intellectual, Gnostic gospel stuff of Elaine Pagels now starts going mainstream in a way that even Elaine Pagels would giggle at the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. But all of a sudden now you have, it's almost like, if you have a lot of respect for history, the evidence for Jesus is mounting. Even when you start out with it totally skeptical, the evidence is mounting. And so it's like, okay, well, let's take the least amount of respect for history that a scholar can have and still call himself or herself a scholar, Elaine Pagels, and let's use that as the launching pad for lay people who have no knowledge whatsoever of history, like Dan Brown, and just let them run with it. And now we've got a dumbed-down culture. So if Dan Brown says the Council of Nicaea, they made Jesus God, the average guy doesn't have any idea what was going on. Doesn't know that everybody who went to that Council of Nicaea, already believed Jesus was God, either the God or a God. What, 316 voted that he is the God, equal to the Father, one in being with the Father. Only two voted that he's a lesser God. Nobody voted that he's merely human. Dan Brown acts like before 325 AD, before the Council of Nicaea, nobody considered Jesus God. What a lack of information person of Dan Brown is. I guess he's a good novel writer if you judge by sales, but he doesn't know his history or theology. But even the Gnostics that he argues for, they deny Jesus' humanity. They thought Jesus was divine in some sense. So Dan Brown doesn't even understand. I mean, the only guys who were arguing for merely human Jesus were the Ebionites, and they were just a real small group, and none of the writings he refers to are Ebionite writings. I don't even know if there's any Ebionite writings other than, well, I mean, I wouldn't call ancient Jewish writings that reject Jesus Ebionite writings, because the Ebionites believed he was the Messiah. They just denied his deity. I mean, they were such a small group. The writings he's referring to deny Jesus' humanity. The New Testament proclaims Jesus' humanity. He claims, Dan Brown claims, that all the Gospels that taught Jesus' humanity were rejected, and only the Gospels that denied his humanity. No! The four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're the ones that proclaim Jesus' full humanity, and they also proclaim his full deity. The Gnostic writings that Dan Brown wants, they're Docetists. They taught that Jesus only appeared to be a man, but really wasn't a man. So even in the Gospel of Judas, Judas is the hero because he betrays Jesus so Jesus could escape from his less than real physical body and return to the ultimate spiritual realm. But Jesus' full humanity is rejected. The sons of Seth, the intellectual elites who are in the know, they have the appearance of humans, but they are really not humans. They're really not of the world of the flesh. But Dan Brown seems to be oblivious to that. I don't mean to be mean to the guy, but he just, you know, he calls things facts that are not facts. Okay, so you have all this evidence for the reliability of the Gospels, reliability of the New Testament itself, going against the Jesus Seminar, and it just, you know, again, it's not the cutting-edge scholarship of the Jesus Seminar that sets them apart. It's just the fact they get all the media attention. And so, unfortunately, whenever Easter or Christmas roll around, the main Christian holidays, Newsweek, Time, CNN, they're going to interview primarily Jesus Seminar guys. So they make it makes it look like, oh wow, this is a, so these poor, ignorant evangelicals, they don't know that New Testament scholars have disproven the resurrection and have disproven that Jesus claimed to be God. And this is the real Jesus. A guy who really wasn't that much different from us. Wow, it's kind of weird that we changed the calendar because of him. And he goes down history as the greatest man who ever lived, when in reality, scholars have proven we know very little about him. Well, that's the reason why we got to come back to Jesus Seminars, because all the media attention they get. Now, I'd like to see if the American media thinks it's very macho, very brave, they're willing to report these things, even if it upsets all these Christians and blah, 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 and then, but then they say Christians are intolerant. No, they know we're not intolerant. So that's why they can, every Easter and every Christmas, we could look at our Jesus on the cover of their magazines and have him blasting within their pages, and they know that nobody's going to blow up the New York Times headquarters or whatever. Now, during the month of Ramadan, I doubt very much they're going to put Muhammad's drawing on the cover as saying Muhammad proven to be a pedophile and all, because Aisha, one of his wives, was only, what, 7, 8, 9 years old when he married her, okay? Even if there's factual evidence, factual stuff there, which there is, Time and Newsweek are not going to put that on the cover and are not going to report that and are not going to mess with the Muslims during their holy month. Because they're a religion of peace, yeah. So even the New York Times, by their actions, that proves they know Christians are really tolerant after all, and they know that Muslims, a high enough percentage of them, tend to take the Quran literally enough to be extremely intolerant and extremely violent. So, but I just like, you know, watching the Da Vinci Code, there was all this bad mouthing of Jesus and Christianity as being intolerant, leading to all the wars and stuff like that. And I looked around and I thought to myself, I know my wife and I are not the only Christians here. I would have been surprised if there weren't at least 50 or 60 Christians there. And none, I was so proud to be a Christian. Nobody heckled. Nobody even yelled. Now, when Salman Rushdie wrote the satanic verses about the Quran slamming Islam, he had to go in hiding for a couple decades because the Ayatollah in Iran called a hit on. There were Muslims all over the world trying to assassinate this guy. Every time he got interviewed, they'd never tell you where he was. Okay? Yet Christians are supposed to be the intolerant. I was like, give me a break. Give me a break. Stop. Yeah, why can't people just be honest? You know, let's have honest dialogue. You don't like Jesus? You got the freedom to reject. Go ahead, reject them and all, but don't lie. The early church, why were they persecuted? Because they were haters of mankind. They weren't a threat to anybody's freedom. I mean, what's the most damage the early Christians did? I don't know. They might have broken a few lions' teeth as the lions started cracking down on their bones and stuff like that. But I mean, fact of the matter is, you don't have a whole lot of evidence for Christian commando units jeopardizing the future of the Roman all-powerful state. But they were branded as the haters of mankind. And so the Rome goes around arresting them and all. And so what do? They were forced to meet in secret. So then Rome says, see, they're meeting in secret. They're conspiring against us. So whatever the case, that's just like a Liberty University where I graduated. They have the greatest debate team in the history of collegiate debate. I mean, all you have to do is they had the national titles. They've won more. They started in 1970. They've won more national titles than any other college in the history of collegiate debate. Way more. They usually win 2 out of 3 of the... There's 3 different national titles you can win. They usually win 2 out of 3 and finish 2nd in the other one. I don't think they've ever lost to Harvard or Yale. Schools like USC usually finish in the top 20, somewhere in the top 20. But whatever the case, now the press has to deal with that sometimes. So they did this big article, and Newsweek did a big article about this great debate team. And then they were basically saying that this is a subversive thing, it's Christians trying to. And when they originally published the article, they said that quoted Jerry Falwell as calling it an assault ministry, A-S-S-A-U-L-T, an assault ministry. And then they had to have a disclaimer at the bottom and say, when we originally wrote this, we quoted Jerry Falwell calling it an assault ministry, like an, you know, assault rifle or something. And so he called us, notified that we were in error, that he said assault ministry. A, one word, S-A-L-T, and then they wrote down how this comes from Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says that you believers are the salt of the earth, and stuff like that. So it's like, so they had to apologize for making such an error. But I mean, they just salivated when they thought he said, you know, it's like an assault ministry. We're our debate team. We're gonna, through our words, we're gonna, you know, kill people or something. And I was like, yeah, killing people through debates is not really. I don't think it's ever been effective. But whatever the case, that's the kind of thing that's going on. But with the Jesus Seminar, what you find are, these are liberal New Testament scholars who really are willing to do underhanded things, really, when it comes down to go to an extreme and to refuse to go with the rest of their liberal buddies who are moving closer and closer to the true Jesus of the Bible, who is the Jesus of history. So that's what we did. We followed the trend of how modernist Enlightenment thinking has influenced the history of Jesus studies since the late 17th century to the present day, and now we see the Da Vinci Code, things going way out left field, but that's not scholarly circles. So now we got to back up, and we'll go back to about World War II with the start of process theology. And so we're not going to be here for four Tuesdays, but when we get back together, we'll talk about process theology, where A.N. Whitehead, he died in 1947, he's one of the foremost leaders, Charles Hartshorne, J.B. Cobb, S.M. Ogden, several others, there's even Teilhard de Chardin, the Roman Catholic thinker, who have process theology. They try to argue that God is this changing being, rather than the theistic God who doesn't change, and God has an infinite aspect to him and a finite aspect to him. The universe is God's body. God is the soul of the universe, and it's somewhere between pantheism, God is the universe, and theism, the personal God who created the universe, somewhere in between, where the universe is God's body. And we'll talk about that. That process theology has made inroads into evangelical circles, where when you have evangelicals, professing evangelicals, who say God does not infallibly foreknow future free choices, that's because they've been influenced by process theology. It's also called panentheism. When you have evangelical theologians saying that God exists in everlasting time, he doesn't exist outside of time. He is an eternal, he exists in everlasting time. They may be very evangelical in other ways, some of these guys, but that's because of the influence, the impact of process theology. So we'll talk about that in about a month when we come back.